America in the Now is now on the air. Oh, had a little bit of dead air there. Oh my goodness, I have been having some technical problems. I consider myself a techno dweeb, but yeah, it's not been working out for me today. I've been doing some enhancements to my Facebook page. I am broadcasting live on Facebook. If you can see me, you can hear me. I'm so glad that you are part of my audience today. There are many of you that this is your first time, and for those of you that are listening to me or watching me for the first time, I want to say welcome. Welcome to America in the Now. We are a weekly show. We are a conservative show. We broadcast out of Attleboro, Massachusetts, every Tuesday afternoon from 5 to 7 p.m., and during these two hours, I talk about issues of interest to not just the community in southeastern Massachusetts, but also the nation. I have a nationwide audience that listens and watches me on Facebook Live, and so that's why every week I go through all these contortions to try to connect this. I jury-rigged the system. One day when I have $1 million, I'll get a more professional system. Actually, the studio here is going to do that for me because they have got this wonderful system of cameras that they're testing, and they're going to be rolling out live. And when they do, I'll be able to broadcast live, piggybacking on their signal. It's pretty cool. As I talk and as different people in the audience that are in the studio talk, the cameras focus on them. So if you'd like to be on the show sometime and you've got a face for TV and not for radio, unlike my face, I have a face for radio, not for TV. I welcome you. I take your calls. I'm happy to speak with you. I always encourage a respectful discussion. If you are polite and if you are passionate, I don't really care if you agree with me or not. As a matter of fact, I like it when people challenge me, and I like it when I have to say, you know what, I'm going to have to get back to you because I don't know enough to really be able to respond. But if you start calling me names, I've got the dump button here. If you start cursing on the air, I'll dump you and I'll ban you, and you'll never be on the air again. And also, you'll show the world how ignorant you truly are. We've got some issues. We've got some issues that as a nation we need to discuss. We need to negotiate, and some things we may need to compromise. But there are certain things that I am not, absolutely not willing to compromise. Funny that I was having a conversation with one of my friends at work. I actually work for a living. I have a 9-to-5 job. They are gracious enough to allow me to leave a little bit early on Tuesday so that I can do the show. I wish I could be here every day, but I don't know if I'd have enough enough content to be able to carry this. But I was telling them, we were talking about a certain topic, which I am going to discuss later on. And my response was, pardon my French, A-E-H-E-L-L, no, as I was banging on the countertop. I said, absolutely not. There are certain things that I'm willing to negotiate on. There are certain things that I'm willing to kind of, you know, say, let's split the difference. But and there are certain areas that I am not willing to give up one tittle of whatever I'm standing for. So for those of you that are new to the audience on Facebook, I do welcome you. Please give me a call. I'm happy to take your call. My phone number is 508-222-1320. 508-222-1320. I usually have someone that calls almost every week or so, my friend Marcus. He definitely and I don't agree on very much. We have kind of similar tactics sometimes, a little bit of snarkiness, a little bit of sarcasm. But I enjoy speaking with him. He did tell me last week that he wouldn't be here, so I'm definitely going to miss him. But I welcome your calls. Again, that number, I'm going to give it a couple times just because I'm experimenting with a slightly new format where I'm giving out the number a little bit more often. If you want to call in, that's fine. If you don't want to call in, that's fine as well. I do get people that leave comments on Facebook or say, hey, talk about this on Facebook. But because, unfortunately, I can't see my Facebook screen on my computer, I'm missing out on those comments, so I'm not going to be able to respond. Doesn't mean I'm ignoring you. It just means, unfortunately, I can't see them. But you know what? I'll try to figure something out. So what has been in the news for the last couple of weeks? The sky is falling. The emperor has no clothes. or the emperor has clothes and nobody wants to admit it. We've got a pandemic that's going to turn us all into zombies. We've got people that are going into stores and buying the entire month's production of toilet paper because they understand or they've learned that in the zombie apocalypse, toilet paper becomes the de facto currency. It becomes the fiat currency for the exchange of goods and services. I don't even know what to say about that. When I go to the local Walmart or Target or grocery store and I buy toilet paper, I usually buy the biggest package that they have. And then I look for the package that has those compressed rolls. So what I do is I go around and I squeeze the rolls. If I can easily squeeze it, that means, you know, there's a lot of air. It's very fluffy and all that. But unfortunately, you use it pretty fast. So I pass. I go for the ones that when I pinch, it's a thick pinch. Those are usually double rolled toilet paper. And so those I buy that and I buy the biggest package. And you know, I have a family of three. It's my wife, myself, and my son. And between the three of us with occasional guests that come to the house and parties and all this, that big thing will last us about 3 months or so. I mean, this deal is going to work itself out. And believe you me, if the toilet paper companies have this huge spike in demand, they're going to increase their production. And so I think I'm good with one big package of toilet paper. And I have a couple of extra rolls from the last time I bought, you know, because I did get a little extra. Usually I buy when I'm down to my last roll, but this time I bought when I had about 5 or 6 rolls left. Now, why the heck am I talking about toilet paper? I feel absolutely ridiculous talking about toilet paper, but I cannot tell you how many videos I've seen on Facebook of people fighting, battling, slapping each other, and just going all out, vicious attacks, mostly women I've seen, over toilet paper. My friends, even if the world ends, don't worry, there's going to be plenty of toilet paper. We'll be right back. You're listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. Yeah, I am making light of the fact that people are freaking out because there's a flu. Let me not minimize the severity of this issue. I don't want you to dismiss me saying, oh, Henry is just some, you know, MAGA hat wearing guy who drank the Kool-Aid and doesn't take, you know, anything seriously. That's definitely not true. I'm a science major. As a matter of fact, I'm a biochemistry major. I'm also a nuclear engineer. So I'm not the smartest guy there is. I jokingly say I used to be smart, but I know in some aspects I'm smart, and I'm very well read. I think that makes the difference. My father, who has a fourth grade education, taught me the value of reading from multiple sources and not relying on just one thing. He read everything he could get his hands on. He is like, in my opinion, he's like Abraham Lincoln. He is self-educated, probably one of the smartest men that I know. And so he instilled in me this love for reading science, fiction, adventure, spy novels, history novels. But I consider myself a scientist, and so I read a lot of science. And I worked in a hospital, so I understand infectious disease. I understand the mechanism by which, you know, people become sick. And I think that's probably the reason why I'm not as freaking out about things, because, you know, ignorance does lead to fear. And when people are afraid and they don't have information, then they just basically assume the worst. And then you've got these little fat ladies, you know, fighting to the death like a gladiator sport over, you know, a couple of rolls of toilet paper. Someone should explain to them the mechanism of coronavirus. So if you'll just bear with me for just a few minutes, I'm going to talk to you about bacterial infection. I'm going to talk to you about viral infection. I'm going to talk about your body's immune system response. All right. So first of all, I've got bad news for you, or good news, depending on how you want to see it. You are absolutely filthy all the time, except for when you just step out of the shower and you've used a lot of soap and you scrub down. Our bodies are covered in bacteria. That's actually a good thing. Why? Think about competition. When you have a barrier that's set up, it's hard for other things to get in. So you have beneficial bacteria. Inside your gut is bacteria. Bacteria are tiny unicellular creatures that have little strands of DNA. Some bacteria can be beneficial. The bacteria that's in your gut actually helps break down carbohydrates and other organic substances in your body, releasing the nutrients. So that's called, you know, you'll hear people talk about the gut flora. It's in your intestines. It's in your stomach. Actually, it's in your intestines. And I think it's in your stomach as well. I forget exactly. When a baby is born and the mother gives the baby breast milk, the baby gets their first injection of bacteria from the mother's milk. Kids need to play, you know, in the dirt, because when they play in the dirt, they're exposed to, you know, to various bacteria that actually strengthens your immune system. So what is your immune system? Your immune system is composed of various components. You have your white blood cells, basically your first line of defense. Then you've got T cells, you've got helper T cells. I'm not going to go into this whole lecture about the body's immune response, but let me explain that if something dangerous gets into your, you know, into your body, for example, you get a cut and you get some bacteria, you'll see that it'll get a little pussy. That's actually white blood cells kind of converging in that area and attacking the bacteria and engulfing them. They actually eat them, digest them, and then you get these byproducts and you get the, you know, the pus, and eventually, you know, the bacteria are killed, goes away, and your body heals. Now, viruses and bacteria are very different. Viruses are actually very, very tiny. And the way they get into your system is they basically take over the body's machines. So whereas a bacteria will lodge into your, let's say, into your intestines and draw out nutrients and water from the bloodstream and then excrete chemicals and basically poison you, what viruses do is they're like invasion of the body snatchers. They actually get inside your cells. They will co-opt the mechanism that each individual, we're composed of billions of cells in different kinds. So they'll grab certain cells, they'll take them over, they'll use them to create more copies of themselves, and then when the cell ruptures, it's released into the system. Obviously, if there's no way for them to get out of the body, then the body dies and the viruses die with it. So these viruses have developed these really novel mechanisms for disbursement. They can use, you know, your intestinal tract. So when you go to the restroom, when you have diarrhea, the viruses are in there, and when people touch it, boom, touch their face or their mouths or gross, then they'll get infected. Other viruses are in your lungs, and so when you cough or you sneeze, you get this little cloud. It's pretty gross when you see a time-lapse photograph of a sneeze. It looks like a little cloud of droplets all filled with viruses that go dispersed. That's called aerosolization. That's pretty bad because, you know, all it takes is one person who's not considerate or doesn't know that they're infected. And they can infect, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of people on their own. So that's why, you know, in Asian societies, people, if they're sick, they'll wear a mask, because if they sneeze, they don't want to, you know, aerosolize their bacteria, which I think is very, very nice. We don't do that in the States. I kind of wish we would. But so you get your bacterial infection, you get your viral infection. Now, why is coronavirus why are flus so deadly? The virus itself isn't deadly per se. Not like AIDS, where AIDS will, you know, immunocompromise you, and basically it'll destroy your body's ability to defend itself against infections, and then any kind of infection will kill you. What coronavirus does is it weakens your immune system to the point where you have what are called secondary bacterial infections. That's the problem with coronavirus. When you get coronavirus and your immune system is weakened, then you do get a bacterial infection in your lungs. And that bacteria basically lodges there and starts sucking the nutrients, and then it excretes waste products, right? And that waste product is what eventually kills you. It shuts your system down. It shuts down your renal system. It shuts down, you know, your maybe a respiratory response. So who is most at risk for dying from the coronavirus? Well, obviously it's people that have compromised immune systems already. So we're talking about the very young and the very old. If you are a relatively young person, you know, from your, let's say, I think it's from your teens through your 50s or 60s, and you're in relatively good health, the chances of you dying from a coronavirus infection is infinitesimally small. It's very, very small. The chances of you being a carrier is big because, you know, you can carry it around. You're doing your stuff. You don't show symptoms. You could be, you know, basically infecting others for weeks and you not even know it. So that's the dangerous part. But people in nursing homes, people, you know, infants, people that are shut-ins, people that are undergoing chemotherapy, those people are kind of in big trouble if they're exposed to the coronavirus. Now, before I go on break, I just wanted to talk about some of the things. Comparing the coronavirus infection to other flu outbreaks. Everyone talks about the SARS, they even bring up the Spanish flu. Now, the Spanish flu broke out, I think it was in 1918, if I'm not mistaken. Spanish flu infected, I heard somewhere, I read that up to a third of the population. There were over 500,000 deaths in the U.S. alone. There were 18 million deaths worldwide. That was a nasty, nasty germ. And there's one reason why it was so mortal. The reason was there were no antibacterial agents. There was no penicillin. There was no way of fighting off bacterial infections. As a matter of fact, this is going to sound crazy to you. Remember, this is not even 100 years. Well, it's about 102 years ago. 102 years ago, the most modern medication and treatment that they had for the flu was bloodletting. They would actually cut you and drain your blood because they thought it was bad blood that was causing them. I mean, this has been done since the 1500s or even earlier. They bloodlet. That was it. They would give you, in France, I think they would give you this wine concoction, heavy wines with heavy herbs. Now, certainly you felt better. I certainly feel better if someone gave me a bunch of French wine, and I don't drink. But that was the treatment. There was no way to treat the bacterial infection that invaded usually the lungs. People would basically drown in their own liquids. It was a horrible way to die. You died of pneumonia. You basically dried in your own liquids because you couldn't breathe. You couldn't get enough oxygen into your system by breathing. That's why all these people died. Obviously, now with our modern, you know, antibacterials, we do have tools. There's an issue of, you know, possible resistance, mutation, so on and so forth. But I think we understand the mechanism for the contraction of the disease. So that's really, really important. At my job, what we do is we have the cleaning crew that come in at night, and they clean all the surfaces. They do wipe downs. They take extra special care to clean, you know, the public spaces that we have. And then what I do, because I'm the oldest guy there, and a lot of the employees they're like my kids. I mean, I will admit it. They're in their 20s and they're afraid. And so I make it a big show. Twice a day, I go through the office and I wipe down using sanitizing wipes. I wipe down all the common area surfaces, doorknobs, handles, machines, phones, as much of the public areas that are used by people as possible. And then we make them responsible to basically police themselves. Each station has a bottle of hand sanitizer. We encourage people to wash their hands. We had a luncheon, kind of company luncheon. And we all sat together, but before anybody could touch anything, they got a squirt of hand sanitizer. So that's kind of the new rule at work. Before you have lunch together, everyone's got to sanitize their hands. And that's worked. So far, I'll tell you, the tension level that existed in our office has gone way down. And I will say, you know, do I get every single area? No. Do I build up a sweat? Yes. Do people see me, and do I make it a point for people to see me cleaning and sanitizing? Yes. Someone actually said to me as I was kind of jutting from one surface area to another, wiping down like a crazy man, because I do it like a crazy man. They said, Henry, thank you for your efforts to keep us healthy. It makes me feel like this company really cares about my health to see what you're doing. And I said, right on, brother. That's exactly how I want you to feel. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about coronavirus because, I mean, this is something that we need to, you know, the more information you have, the more you can do. I'm going to give you some tips, some tools, and then what to do if stuff runs out. We'll be right back. You're listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. It sure is hard to feel panicky and to be afraid when you're listening to REM. All right, we're back. If for those of you that are listening or watching on Facebook, you're probably seeing me kind of bopping my head up and down. This song goes way back. I think it was back in 1985, if I'm not mistaken. I was in college back then, back in the prehistoric Stone Age. And we were having a party, and I remember dancing with some girls to this song. And it was after having been in a combat zone for two tours, after having been in the military for 6 years, going to college and feeling so free and so liberated, dancing with beautiful young women, it was probably the time of my life. And I cherish those memories, and I'm grateful. And sometimes I think, you know, these cute little things that I'll admit I lusted after, but I never did anything. I was always a complete gentleman. Now they're probably mothers, and their kids are probably the ages of my kids, you know. So now if I see them, I'll see their kids, I'll say, wow, you look just like your mom. But it's not the end of the world. It's not going to be the end of the world, but you do have to take precautions, because if you don't watch out, you're gonna get the coronavirus. And if you're in that compromised demographic, it ain't going to be good for you. And that's something that we need to be mindful of. So, what can you do? What can you do to not prevent the you know, being infected with coronavirus, because you can't really prevent it unless you live, you know, unless you're retired to like Montana, go into your secret lair, you know, go down 100 feet, close the door, breathe recycled air and just come back in 6 months. For the rest of us who live in the real world and have mortgages to pay and children's tuition bills to come up with and all the other stuff, this is what you can do. First of all, don't panic. But it's not a bad idea to have a little prepper in you. And what do I mean by that? I mean, I have a sister that lives in New York City. And I love her. I love her to death. But she drives me crazy. Why? Because when I asked her, when I visited her, I said, hey, you know, if you were to lose power, you're on the 18th floor of a building. If you lose power, you know, you can't walk that well. How would you survive? And she says, well, you know, I've got stuff here. And I said, okay, show me what you got. She had a half a gallon of water in her refrigerator. She had a box of biscuits. And she had, I think, a couple of cans of tomato paste and maybe a 3 pound bag of rice. Or I think it's a 1 pound bag of rice. And some Vienna sausages. Puerto Ricans call it salchicha. And so when she showed me, she was actually proud. She says, you see, I'll be fine for a while. I said, well, what do you mean a while? She goes, you know, things come back in New York in a day or so. I said, honey, we're talking about something that, what if you lose power in New York and it's gone for 2 weeks and you can't go up down the stairs? And because there's no power, there's no water, because there's no pressure. So you have no water, you have an electric stove, so you can't cook. How are you going to survive? And she says, oh, you know, I'm not that worried about it. You know, I'll be fine. Oh my goodness. I mean, I love my sister, but oh God, God help us. Because if the zombie apocalypse comes, I'm going to have to drive to New York, pick her up, fight through the traffic, get through all the zombies and bring her back to Massachusetts. If she's going to have a snowball's chance in hell of surviving. Now, hopefully, knock on wood, knock on head, that's not going to happen. But it's not a bad idea to be prepared. And this is what you need, all right? So I have prepper friends that are crazy. I mean, they got food for the next 25 years. And it's all like, you know, freeze-dried astronaut food, stuff that I would never eat unless I was dying, and that's the only thing that was left. I would go and get myself, if you buy 5 boxes of macaroni and cheese, buy an extra 10 boxes. If you buy rice, buy an extra 2 bags of rice. Now, if you're if you have an Asian wife like I do, two bags of rice ain't enough. So we got 200 pounds of rice in our house. Maybe I shouldn't be sharing that, but oh well, it's out there. That's how she feels comfortable. And she told me the other day, I don't think we have enough rice. I said, honey, we have enough rice. I'm not eating that. I'm not eating 250 pounds of rice or 300 pounds or whatever it is. If most people buy like the, I think it's a 5-pound bag of rice or maybe the instant rice. If you buy the box of instant rice, get an extra two boxes. Get one or two extra. Get two extra cans of tomato sauce. Get some tuna fish. Tuna fish is a great food. It's high in protein. It's low in, you know, low in salt. So it can be fed to people that have all kinds of caloric restrictions. I'm a vegetarian, but believe me, you know, during tough times, you do what you got to do. I'm a vegetarian because I have the luxury of being a vegetarian. But if I, you know, if I have to eat meat because that's all there is because I'm hunting, then that's what I would do. But you get extra cans of tuna fish. They're cheap, 89 cents. You get 10 cans. Put them to the side. You can always use them later for macaroni and cheese with tuna sandwiches, tuna casserole, tuna bisque, tuna this, tuna whatever. Get some mayonnaise. I mean, what I do is, you know, maybe the single portion mayonnaise because get a couple packets of that because you have to assume that there will be no refrigeration. So I buy foods that don't have to be refrigerated. I also have a lot of water. I mean, again, I don't want to sound like the paranoid prepper, but I have enough water to last me a little while. The guideline is 1 gallon of water per person per day. And that's been true since the Navy days. On the USS Constitution, we learned that sailors were given a ration of 1 gallon of water a day. Now, they could use that water however they wished. They could wash their clothes, they could brush their teeth, they could bathe with it, or they could drink it. So guess how badly the ship smelled. That's right, because people would rather drink the water than bathe with it. So, but a gallon doesn't, it sounds like you may say, a gallon, no, that's way too much. I'm not going to be drinking a gallon of water. You'd be surprised how much water you actually drink in prepared foods. And also, you're going to need water to flush the toilet, so you're going to have to set some water aside to flush toilets, to wash dishes, things of that sort. So 1 gallon per person per day is actually minimal. Obviously, get some hand sanitizer if you can find it. Toilet paper, yes, get toilet paper, but don't go crazy. Get something that'll last you, get the big thing that'll last you 3 months. So we talked about macaroni and cheese, right? Extra mac and cheese, extra tuna fish. If you like those sausage rolls, that works fine. I know in Hawaii, man, we're big on Spam. So, you know, every house has got probably 30, 40 cans of Spam. Spam lasts forever. It's, it is what it is. It's Spam. I mean, it's actually pretty versatile. You can do a lot with it. Canned vegetables. Now, I tell people, be careful with buying canned vegetables because most people don't eat canned vegetables. So if you spend $100 in canned vegetables, chances are you're going to throw out $100 worth of canned vegetables when this whole crisis passes and it's been, 2 years, and you go into your pantry and you see the $100 or $200 worth of canned vegetables that you never ate. So I tell people, don't buy things that you ordinarily don't eat. Buy the things that you eat and buy a little bit of things that you ordinarily don't eat, but that, once the crisis is over, you'll say, well, I don't eat this every day, but I'll go ahead and eat it. And that's where the canned vegetables, the canned fruits comes into play. Now, unfortunately, I don't have enough canned vegetables because I don't like them. I figure I can last a couple months without eating vegetables, but eventually I'm going to have to figure something else. So maybe I'll trade. And that's pretty much, that's it. You can set up a little space in your closet. You call it your prepper space. Or just organize your pantry. Oh, I forgot, mashed potatoes. Dried mashed potatoes, excellent stuff, man. You can use that on so many different things. I bake, so I've been doing that since my kids were little. So I bought, flour. And with flour, you can bake things. You can. It's a thickener for stews. And then I also purchase, I always have, and I rotate it out, dry milk. Milk and these packages. You can buy the big bags, which I don't really like. I prefer the smaller bags that allows me to make 1 quart at a time. And with a quart, I can use it. You know, I can use it in baking stuff, my cereal. I don't really like it, but it's better than nothing. So, you know, and again, during a time where you're kind of ensconced in your home, being able to make things that you're familiar with, even if it doesn't taste exactly the same, is not a bad thing. And have some cooking oil as well, because you can always replace cooking oil with butter, especially olive oil. Olive oil is a wonderful oil, and if you cook with butter, you can use olive oil. It's actually healthier for you, and it still gives you that sensation. You know, buy a little thing, not a big thing of salt, but just an extra container of salt, some sugar, and if you're a coffee drinker, get coffee. I mean, you can drink coffee that's unheated. You can just mix it basically with water and drink it that way. It's gross. I don't like it. Well, some people like iced coffee, but I don't like it. But you can do that as well. So that's pretty much your prepper suggestions. You don't have to go crazy. You'll probably spend an extra maybe $200, maybe $300, depending on your family. I mean, if you have a big family, you're going to have to spend an extra $300. But this is one of those deals where this is kind of not an emergency, but this is urgent. So putting it on your credit card is warranted, but just make sure you pay it off, because you know, last thing you want to do is blow up your credit because you're prepping for the end of the world. We'll be right back. You are listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. Happy to take your calls. After the break, I'm at 508-222-1320. Again, that number is 508-222-1320. I'm going to do a little politics after the break. We'll be right back. You're listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. This is called Chinese Medicine by King Nun. Bunch of young guys singing. It's actually a pretty cool video. If you go to YouTube, you'll be able to see it. Again, it's called Chinese Medicine by King Nun, N-U-N. Why am I bringing this up? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we do have a problem. And this is what makes me concerned. The coronavirus, I can manage. I can wash my hands. I can sanitize surfaces. I can stockpile food, water, ammunition. Not that I'm a supporter of the Second Amendment right. Whether I choose to carry or possess a weapon, that's up to me. That's my business, not yours. But I can do all that stuff, right? But the one thing that I cannot do is buy medicine if it's not available. This is a dirty little secret about the pharmaceutical industry that I've suspected, but I didn't really know until recently. It was confirmed. Now, when you're taking a medicine, right, you see that if you take, you know, let's say you're taking aspirin, right? Aspirin is actually a chemical. It's acetylsalicylic acid. That is the active ingredient in aspirin. When you take an aspirin pill, that aspirin pill is not 100% acetylsalicylic medicine. It's actually some like dietary powder, some starch, an emulsifant, it's maybe a hardening agent. I mean, it's something that's designed to kind of encapsulate the medicine and then deliver it either quickly or slowly, right? Time release capsules. That means it takes, you know, it doesn't release all at once. It releases a little bit at a time. So all of these medicines, you know, they have different, some come in capsules, some come in tablets, you know, some come in liquid form. But they're all prepared, and they all have, you know, certain amounts of chemicals, you know, precise, they're supposed to be precise amounts of chemicals that are delivered. Some medicines have different chemicals, but usually most medicines is just one chemical. Now, in order to make acetylsalicylic acid, you need to have various compounds, right? So you don't like harvest acetylsalicylic acid from the ground. You don't like go, you know, with a scythe and harvest aspirin pills from a beautiful valley of, you know, white pills. You actually have to have the chemicals. Then you combine them, you know, basically you use chemistry to take certain chemicals like water, hydrogen, carbon, sulfides, so on and so forth, and you cook them to a certain way so that it produces the chemical compounds that you're looking for that has the specific biological there's a scientific term, I forget what it's called now, that has a certain amount of bioavailability to you. That's fine and dandy. Here's the problem. Oh, great, my phone is ringing. The phone that I'm using, too. One moment, please. Ah!
Hey, don't use my phone. That's my son. He knows better than to call me during the America in the Now broadcast, but that's what he's doing.
So as I was speaking, I lost my train of thought. In order to make these chemicals, you have to have them, right? And what pharmaceutical companies do is they buy them in bulk. And they want to buy them in bulk because, obviously, you know, the cheaper the compound, the more your profit, right? Everybody loves profit. You want to make as much profit as possible. I do not fault manufacturers for doing this. But here's the problem. They've chosen to use an unreliable supplier. Now, they have controls in place and all of this. That's fine. But now this black swan event, or this white swan event, depending on which swan you prefer, has caused a problem. Because in China, because of the quarantines that they've had, factories have had to shut down, which means the factories that produce the precursor chemicals, i.e. the chemicals that are used to make the medicines that many Americans take, are no longer available. So they're not being shipped, which means that the pharmaceutical companies here now don't have the chemicals that they need to make the medications, which means patients, eventually, if this continues, patients are going to run out of medicine. And this was done to increase the profitability of a product by a tiny sliver. This, in my opinion, is absolutely irresponsible. I'm a capitalist, man. I believe in capitalism. I want to be, you know, rich just like the other guy. And I want to find efficiencies in the system. And I'm not criticizing companies that look to leverage their advantages in logistics and in purchasing power to get the best possible deal worldwide. But understand that when you put yourself at this is a very real risk that's been revealed. Nobody assumed that this would happen, or maybe they just hoped it wouldn't happen, or they figure maybe we'll stockpile enough, and I'm hoping that they've stockpiled enough precursor chemicals that they can continue operations. But this is the reason why local manufacturing is so very important. Local production of the things that we need in this country is so very important. And I don't want to sound like a trade protectionist here. I'm treading on some very slippery ground because I'm not a trade protectionist. But I think we have to be strategic in how we look at the markets. I don't think China is our friend. I'm just going to put it that way. The Chinese people, absolutely. I have nothing against Chinese people. I work with many Chinese people. I actually admire them. I admire their culture. I admire their history. I admire their work ethic. I'll tell you, I hire Chinese nationals. You know, I put them to work. I have no issues, no drama, nothing. They work. They're good employees. They're loyal. They're hardworking. They're everything that I want from an employee. I'm talking about the Chinese government. The Chinese government's aim is to destroy us. Do not be fooled. Do not be bamboozled. Their political system is diametrically opposed to ours, and their goal is to bury us. Just like Nikita Khrushchev said in the 1950s to us in the UN, he said, and I quote, "We will bury you." They believe that. These are communists. Communism and democracy are incompatible. It is like oil and water. They do not mix. Why in the name of Sam Hill are we by default handing over our industries and exposing the soft underbelly of our current liability when it comes to medication, the chain of the creation of critical medicines? If we run out of aspirin, we can always get, you know, aspirin from somebody else. But there are certain precursor chemicals that now the Chinese have basically an exclusive deal on. That is stupid. That is absolutely the stupidest thing that I've heard that this country has done. And it is to make a couple of pennies of profit for every $100. I understand, you know, when you're talking hundreds of millions and billions, you know, that stuff adds up. I understand all that. But I'm very glad that in some areas, this is a wake-up call to America. This is a chance for us to realize that our perfect little worlds of cell phones that come from China, manufactured by slave labor, that's correct,
Your Adidas sneakers and some of your Apple phone components are manufactured by prisoners. We cannot continue doing this to ourselves. We are putting ourselves at the mercy of a system of government that when they have the opportunity to plunge the knife into our throats and kill us, they will not hesitate one moment. Do not be fooled, my friends. This is a struggle for survival, and our systems are incompatible. We need to have a relationship based on strength with the Chinese. We need to leverage their advantages, absolutely, but we also can never hand over the advantages that we have. We must maintain the market advantages that we have, because when events like this happen, we can be prepared. And thank God that we're actually in much better shape than most other countries. We are in much better shape. And that part is, that part actually makes me feel a little bit better. I'm a big reader of the Epoch Times. I love the Epoch Times. This is a conservative paper. Their motto is truth and tradition. And they also say, if you can prove it, we'll print it. So what they said is, there's a House bill that aims to strengthen medical supply chain amid coronavirus crisis. And I'm so glad that is indeed the case. I'll read this article after the break. You are listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. Thank you so much for your patronage. Thank you so much for listening. We're going to do a little bit more politics. And I'm going to talk a little bit about my state Senate campaign, because obviously I'm running. I don't want to, you know, mix the show and the state Senate campaign too much. But, I mean, it is my deal. And as long as I have an opportunity to talk about it, I will. We'll be right back. You're listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. Money, money, money. That's the OJs, for the love of money. It goes money, 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 money. Look, I am an entrepreneur just like everybody else. I was going through, or like other people, or some people, I should say. I'm putting together some business cards for my upcoming state Senate run in Massachusetts. And as I was doing that, I went to Vistaprint, which is the site that I go to buy like all the stuff. It's just easy for me. I've gotten, you know, I get my business cards, my checking account, and then when my church has different activities, I bought banners, I bought placards. I mean, so I have a history of all the different orders that I've made going back to, I think, 2007, 2008. And I was amazed at the money that I've wasted, I guess you might say, on business cards, different business concepts that I've had, RFID tags for school security, consulting, recruitment, actually a car sharing service. This was before Uber. Different things. I've definitely have tried many, many different ideas, because I'm looking for that opportunity to make some money. And in some things, I've actually been somewhat successful. Other things, you know, it didn't pan out. But that's the secret. That's the secret to success. You keep trying until you succeed. You don't just, you know, try something, or, you know, don't try and then don't even, you know, give it a shot. There's a little Chinese cookie fortune that I keep in my wallet. It says, in all great endeavors, it is glorious even to fail. And so that's what I believe. I believe that I'm going to keep trying different things. So when I talk about money and things, I hope you understand that's kind of my perspective. I'm definitely not a socialist. I'm definitely not one of these people that believes that, you know, money should be distributed to the poor. Heck no, man. Rich people should keep as much of their money as possible. They earned it. They made sacrifices. They took risks. It's theirs. It ain't yours. You want a slice of the pie? Then go get it yourself, dude. That's my response. I'm bringing this up because sometimes the love and lust of money makes people do stupid and crazy and dangerous and illegal things. And this is something that we need to be mindful of when it comes to these issues. So let me bring up this article. Again, it's the Epoch Times. I really like this newspaper. It costs me $17 a month to have everyday online access. And they mail me a paper copy every Sunday. Or every Saturday, which is nice, because I used to read the Sunday paper, but I got out of the habit. But with the Epoch Times, I can sit down and read the paper, and I go through it. And every week, I'll pull a little article. There's a couple articles that I did want to share with the audience. Before I go, let me again give you the number. It's 508-222-1320. 508-222-1320. Before I talk about this article, I did want to bring something else up about coronavirus, and then I'm going to set that aside because I think I pretty much beat that one to death. And that is, you know, how do you minimize coronavirus? I think I talked about it, but I'm going to bring it up one more time because I really want people to feel that they're in control. You know, if you feel that you're in control of the situation, your apprehension level is going to be a heck of a lot less than if, you know, you don't know what's next. So how do you minimize exposure to coronavirus? Well, the easiest way and the most effective way, believe it or not, is hand washing, right? You hear this. You hear this all the time. When before this whole corona thing, there was someone who would use, when, if I was in the restroom, like usually in the stall, right? Someone would come into the restroom, they'd use a urinal, and then they'd walk out the door. And because I'm in a compromising position, I can't get up quickly enough and go and find out who that person is and then approach them later on and say, dude, you know, not a bad idea to use, you know, the soap and water, even though you're not defecating, you're just using, you know, you're just urinating. Even then, people still, you know, there's still bacteria in here that you're carrying out to the office. Haven't been able to catch that person. But I'm going to start memorizing shoes and then walk around the office and see who's got that shoes. But I tell people, hand washing is the most important thing you can do. When you wash your hands, soap acts as what's called a surfactant. A surfactant means that it brings things to the surface, right? Surfactant. So if you've got bacteria on your hands, which you do, or viruses on your hand, which you may, when you wash, it basically takes it off of your skin, puts it in the water, and away it goes down the drain. And then the treatment system, you know, takes care of that for you. That's the most effective tool that you can use. Why? Think about it. If I were to say something now, you're probably going to do it, even if I tell you not to do it. So here it is. Don't touch your face. What's happening now? Chances are, if you're like me, or maybe you're not like me, when people say don't touch your face, you instinctively touch your face, even though they say don't touch your face. Why? There's a lot of psychological reasons for it, right? But if you watch videos of people, you'll see over 10 minutes, people will be touching their faces, rubbing their eyes, touching their nose. All it takes is one virus to get inside your nose, inhaled, and boom, it's in a soft, wet space, and it can wreak havoc in your system. And so the easiest way to minimize, remember, not eliminate, but minimize the chances of you carrying viruses is, boom, wash your hands with soap and water. And what you do is, as you're washing, first of all, you wet your hands. Sorry, guys. We're back in kindergarten, okay? My wife is a school principal, so she does this all the time. You wet your hands, put a little dab, a tiny dab of soap, doesn't have to be a whole lot, just a tiny dab of soap, and rub it, you know, over and over, and then between your fingers. I'm actually doing it for my Facebook audience. You kind of, you know, in your fingers, all around your fingers, get it all nice and soapy up to your wrists, right? Rub, rub, rub. And then you put it under the water. And while you're putting it under the water, you sing, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear me. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear me. Happy birthday to you. Done. It's about 20 seconds. You have now just washed your hands and removed, you know, possibly offensive bacteria and everything else. Take a towel. Right, dry it. I don't like those electric dryers. Someday I'll talk more about that, but I like to have just a paper towel. Dry with a paper towel, and then I use the paper towel to open the doorknob of the bathroom if I have to open the doorknob, and that way, I minimize the chance that some dweeb who just, you know, pooped in the bathroom and didn't wash their hands, they wiped, you know, their butts, and now they're touched the doorknob with their butt, basically. So that's what I do. Then I kind of wipe the doorknob and out I go to my thing. Does that make me paranoid? No, it makes me conscious. I was a healthcare worker, so I understand how infectious disease can be transmitted. The second most important thing that you can do is, you know, wipe down your surfaces. Get a disinfectant wipe, and in the morning when you work, wipe off your phone, right? The phone handle, the phone micro piece, the buttons on the phone, your keyboard, your mouse, filthy thing, right? And your surface area. You've just, you know, you've just cleaned up your kind of your work area. And as long as nobody comes over to your work area and kind of leans against your, you know, your desk with their open palm on your desk, you're going to probably keep that clean throughout the whole day. They say, you know, keep your distance from people, you know, the social distance of 6 feet. Sometimes that's not possible because, like, you're on a train. If you're really worried about possible transmission from people, especially if things get really bad, having a mask is better than nothing. I mean, there are certain masks that are better than others. You know, a dust mask is not going to help. You really need a surgical mask or a proven mask. So some of these masks that you see at the stores, they're good for preventing you from spreading the disease, but they're not good at preventing you from getting the disease if it's in the air. So that's why having an actual surgical mask, which covers the entire mouth, that's what you really need, not those little flat ones. Now, we have those little flat ones at the office. Okay, part of it is probably prophylactic, but if it helps people feel better, you know, and kind of keeps them mindful of not touching their faces, and just being kind of cognizant that, you know, that they can potentially cross-contaminate something, so they should wash their hands every time. They should sanitize at least maybe twice a day at their station. That's going to really minimize almost to zero your chances of getting the coronavirus. So something to keep in mind. I'm going to continue reading this article when we get back from the break. You're listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. You're listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. Okay, for those of you who don't know, by the way, I am Puerto Rican. That doesn't mean I get a pass when it comes to making ethnic comments, but I just wanted to bring this music because I like it. I like the Mexican hat dance. I actually learned the Mexican hat dance when I was a fifth grader at PS332 in Brooklyn. There were no Mexicans in that school. It was all Puerto Ricans and blacks. But we still learned the Mexican dance, and I must say, I was not good at it then, and I'm not good at it now. But it was cool to watch the little girls dancing. Even then, I liked the girls. Now they're women. Actually, now they're grandmothers. Why am I bringing up this song? We have a problem. I was talking earlier about greed and about money. There are people in this world who don't care about others. They will kill you for the $5 you have in your pocket and not even think twice. They will steal from you without you even knowing. They will plunder your home if they have the opportunity. They will cheat, lie, and steal if that means that they can get extra money. So I don't understand why people are surprised that the Mexican cartels are using our open borders to push huge amounts of methamphetamine and fentanyl into the United States. Fentanyl is one of the most addictive, destructive drugs in the world. More people in this country die from fentanyl overdosing than died in the Vietnam War combined. Over 50,000 deaths occur from people that overdosed on fentanyl. It is tragic. Methamphetamine is one of the most addictive drugs. They say that all it takes is one hit to be addicted. I have seen pictures of the devastation that a methamphetamine addiction can wreak on a human being's body. These people go from being, I guess, young, maybe attractive people, to being just these ulcer-ridden, horrible-complexioned, skinny, probably disease-ridden human beings. I shudder to think at the depravities that these people, these children of God, had to undergo in order to make money so that they could sustain this horrible habit. Meanwhile, I almost said a bad word on radio. thank goodness, because I don't want the station to lose the license. I'll just use the contraction. I'll use the initials. Some SOB, or I could say some FSOB, in Mexico, or in other parts of Latin America, and in China, by the way, because that's a big market in China as well, is raking in huge amounts of American money on the misery of stupid Americans who didn't take the advice to don't take that hit. Don't succumb to the temptation. Don't self-medicate. So this article says, again, the Epoch Times, Arizona Sheriff says cartels create demand by flooding communities with free or cheap drugs to get people addicted. This is in Pinal County, Arizona. If drugs aren't stopped along the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona's remote desert, chances are a large proportion will end up traveling through Pinal County on its way to Phoenix, a major trafficking hub. And from Phoenix, it goes to California, to Texas, to Florida, to New York, to Chicago. Wherever there is demand for drugs, these drugs will find consumers. Around 40% of illicit drugs enter the United States through Arizona, said Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb. That's staggering. Hard narcotics, such as heroin, methamphetamines, and fentanyl, are usually hidden in vehicles and driven through one of Arizona's 7 ports of entry along its border, while marijuana has traditionally been backpacked through the desert between border crossings. In the past few years, Mexican drug cartels have been flooding the United States with methamphetamine and fentanyl, driving the supply so hard and dropping the price so low, supply and demand, that it pushes up addiction rates and the market then demands more drugs, right? The more supply you have, the lower the price, the lower the price, the easier it is to obtain, the more you use, the more demand, eventually price goes up again. Our demand is based on what the cartel's pushing. The demand is what the cartels create in our society, Lamb told the Epoch Times. So they go out into an areas and they will give out meth at reduced prices or free to certain places. They love rural areas, hardworking blue-collar people that are life has got its boot on their throats. They get into these communities, and then it trickles into the cities. And once they're into the cities, it's a lot easier. The increase is reflected in meth seizures at the border, especially at ports of entry. Border agents seized more than 82,000 pounds of meth along the whole southern border. I don't even know what 82,000 pounds is. Let's see. My car weighs... I got a heavy car, what, 4,000 pounds? So basically 20 cars worth of methamphetamine. And imagine how much methamphetamine you take. I mean, you don't take a pound of methamphetamine. It's not like a quarter pounder, you know, where if you have 10 pounds of burgers, you can serve, you know, you can have 40 burgers. I mean, we're talking minuscule amounts of methamphetamine to get people intoxicated. So these are probably millions and millions of doses. I mean, think about the misery that you know, 2 million doses of methamphetamine or fentanyl is causing in this country, the lost productivity, the broken families, the desperation, the inclination for these addicts to engage in immoral and illegal behaviors just to satisfy their habits. I mean, my heart goes out to them, man. I almost feel a little bit It makes me emotional, and there's a reason why. Because I've had tragedy in my family with drug addiction. I've lost too many a cousin and too many an uncle to addictions. So when I think about especially one cousin that I especially loved, who died because of drugs, it fills me with sadness and with teeth clenching anger. Sorry, I'm going to compose myself. I'd like to continue reading this article. In fiscal year 2019, compared to less than 24,000 pounds. So last year was 82,000 pounds. This in 2014, just 5 years ago, they confiscated 24,000. Now, it could be that they just didn't catch it all, or there was not as much coming through. And this is what they catch. Imagine what gets through. And the gentleman says, I would venture to say that we're not capturing 20%, Lamb said, of the border seizures. It's probably more around like 10%. So for every pound that they catch, 10 pounds are getting through. Inside the U.S., DEA seizures of meth more than doubled from 50,000 pounds in 2017 to 112,000 pounds in fiscal 2019. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a crisis. LAM's office in Pinal County seized 3,000% more meth in 2019 than it did in 2018. It's a billion-dollar business that will change only if the cartel's bottom line takes a significant hit, LAM said. Take Walmart, for example. Walmart has an accepted loss ratio that they'll accept, whether it's through theft, damaged goods, stolen goods, or whatever it may be. They're not going to change their ways very much unless it exceeds that threshold. Well, the cartel's no different. They're a billion-dollar industry, and they have their own threshold. He said that it's between 20 to 25%, so they're not even impacting that. Here's the number of deaths caused by psychostimulants, predominantly methamphetamines. It increased by 37% from 2016 to 2017. More than 10,000 Americans died from an overdose involving psychostimulants in 2017. And by the way, that's just methamphetamine. We're not even talking about fentanyl. This is why we need to have a secure border, my friends. This is the kind of crap that's filtering through our borders. I have an issue with illegal aliens. I do. And I've talked about this on my show. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that as well. I have very strong opinions about that. But why the heck is it that we're making it so easy for this stuff to come across the border? We need to institute very strong border controls. We need to have a strong fence. We need to have a border that's as impermeable as can be. There is no such thing as a perfectly permeable border because we don't want to set up, you know, machine gun nests and landmines and all that other stuff. Obviously, we don't want to do that. At the same time, there's a reason why we have an appetite for drugs. That's a whole other issue. But let's not make it easy for drug addicts to satisfy that demand. I would much rather someone in the heartland looking at their kids filled with love and say, I need to stop doing this for my kids. I need to be here for them. I need to be a provider. I need to stop wasting our money on this stuff. That stuff is so expensive anyway. You know what? It's time for me to get help. But when it's so easy to buy and it's just, if you're having a bad day, for $5, you can be in La La Land. I understand. I understand the allure, but we have to resist. I was told by my doctor that I have to lay off the salty, I have to lay off salt, period. I have to minimize my salt intake. So what does my friend do? She doesn't really know. We get snacks in our office, and the chips, they go really fast. And she knows that I love those kettle chips. So she says, Henry, I got you a bag of kettle chips for your stash. And I said, I love you. I can't eat this, but I'm going to put it in my drawer. And every day, of course, I open my drawer. What do I see? I see that stinking bag of chips with extra salt, I think, or it's not the reduced salt. It's the regular salt. For the last 3 weeks, I open my drawer 2 times a day, and there's that darn bag of chips. I don't have the courage to give it back to her or set it out in the common area because it'll be snagged immediately. I have it in my drawer. So in a way, I understand temptation. How long will I last? I don't know. But as of yet, it's been 3 weeks. I have not opened that bag of chips, and I have minimized my salt intake. We need to do something about this. We need to make sure that this is something that is minimized, that the price of the drugs is high, and that the cost to do business becomes prohibitive for these organizations, and they decide maybe to, I don't know, do something else. Hopefully something legit. We'll be right back. You are listening to America in the Now, and I am your host, Henry Roman.
Republican!
Listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. I've always liked the Beastie Boys. I must say, I never quite understood their music or their allure, but the older I get, the realize these guys are actually pretty smart. They're all from the Red Hook section of Brooklyn, if I'm not mistaken. So they're definitely, you know, legit, unlike Vanilla Ice, who was raised in, you know, suburbia. These guys are definitely, you know, somewhat inner-city Brooklynites. You got to fight for your right to party by the Beastie Boys. I feel like I'm a college DJ. We have a problem, another problem, I guess. And this is the partisan divide that I talk a little bit about. You might say in some ways I am part of the partisan divide, but I am not trying to create divisions. I am trying to state my case. I am trying to present a logical argument for why I believe the way I do. You may not agree with me. You may feel that what I have to say is, you know, that I'm being mean, or it's not fair, or you know, I just don't understand. You're right. I'm on a journey. And there are some things that I think I know. There are some things that I know, but I'm old enough to know that the things that I think I know and the things that I know, there may be some room there for some adjustment. And so last year now, it's been a year, I preached a sermon. I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, and if some people are offended that I'm a conservative Seventh-day Adventist, I can say I'm sorry that you feel that way, or I can say tough, too bad. You don't like it? You don't like my show? You don't like my opinions? Don't listen. But this is my journey, and this is how I feel. Am I going to dismiss your ideas? No. Am I going to listen? Yeah, I'd like to hear what you've got to say. But I've actually had people that have been dismissive of me simply because I don't agree with them. But they can't reason with me as to why they believe the way they do. I think part of this has to do with like victim mentality and some other stuff. Last year, at a sermon that I was delivering at the church, I said that I am pro-choice. But I also said that abortion should be three things, not one or two, but three. It should be safe, it should be legal, and it should be rare. It should be so rare that it is not a freaking profit center for hospitals. Planned Parenthood bills the United States government almost $700 million for abortion services. Adventist hospitals bill millions for abortion services. They are peddlers of death. You call it whatever you want to, my body, my choice, yeah. The fact of the matter is, that is a unique human being with a unique genetic code that has not been given the opportunity to live because he or she is an inconvenience to the mother. Not because the health of the mother is at stake. Not because this is a horrible something that after much prayer and consideration, the only option is an abortion. I don't believe that the mental health and happiness of the mother is sufficient criteria to kill and sacrifice an innocent unborn to Moloch. Because I'm convicted that abortions are modern-day sacrifices to the devil god. And I know this because every time I see videos of anti-abortionists protesting, inevitably a countergroup will start yelling, "Hail Satan." You don't believe me? Go on YouTube and look. Inevitably, there's someone that start yelling, "Hail Satan," where Christians are cooperating in the devil's work. That's how I feel about that. There's a book in the Bible that I love very much. I'm gonna look it up because I wish I knew it by heart. I don't. Jeremiah 1:5, I think it is. Yes, this is a beautiful, there are many Bible verses that are absolutely beautiful. In Jeremiah 1:5, it says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations. Now, there are people that will dismiss me, and I've seen the hands. I feel like punching them in the face when they do that to me. You know, God's not finished with me yet. I'm a little rough around the edges, guys. Bear with me. I'm still growing. I'm from Brooklyn, so I've definitely got some rough edges around me. To me, this Bible verse says that even before you were a recognizable human being, i.e. you were a clump of cells, when you were a clump of cells in the Bible, in your mother's womb, God already knew you, and he had plans for you. Maybe you're not going to be the prophet. God was talking to Jeremiah specifically in here, but no one can tell me, oh no, that was only for Jeremiah. The Ten Commandments is not for some people and for other people. The Bible doesn't say, well, this applies to you, it doesn't apply to you. It applies to everybody. God has plans for everyone. My response at church is, God had a plan for the unborn child before it was even recognizable as a human being. Who do we think we are to interfere with God's plan? Who has anointed us gods? Who has said that we can usurp God's plan for our children? I think, had I gotten up and said, "Hail Satan," at church, I think I would have had more people that were actually supportive of me. Had I said, "I'm going to talk about how I love Satan and how hail Satan on everything," I think I would have had more people that would, to this day, would be more supportive of me. Because the firestorm that I unleashed by saying what I said. Now, granted, the way I said it, it's good for radio, probably not good for churches. But I was there to make a point. Sometimes you gotta make a point, my friends. Sometimes you can't pussyfoot around. You can't beat around the bush. You can't dawdle, hesitate, pause. Use whatever nice, flowery, fancy word you want to. Sometimes you gotta say it like it is. I had a friend from Montana when I was in the Navy. This guy, oh man, he had an unfiltered, definitely an unfiltered brain. He would tell you his opinion, whether you liked it or not. And some of his opinions, I mean, the guy was, you know, he was a borderline racist, man. I mean, I have to admit, the guy was a bit of a racist. But, you know, he was raised in an all-white community. There were no, at that time, we're talking about the 70s, you know, there were no minorities for 200 miles from where he lived. He'd never, you know, interacted with any of them. He'd heard stereotypes. You know, I was probably the first Puerto Rican he ever met. I remember him saying to me, you know, Henry, I've heard all these things from other people about Puerto Ricans, but you're not like one of those people. Are you different? I said, no, they're just maybe... You just haven't met more of me than the others. He says, well, I figured Puerto Ricans are like you, not like what other people are saying, and walked away. I thought, okay, well, that's strike one for you know, race relationships. Sometimes you've got to be tough. Sometimes you've got to be firm. Sometimes you've got to take a risk. I took a risk, and I lost. I will admit, I lost. But I also developed a lot of strong backers. I have friends that are loyal. Even now, they watch me on Facebook. They follow me. They are very supportive of me, and I'm going to hopefully take advantage of those relationships to help me win in Massachusetts in November. The reason I'm bringing this up is just because you have strong opinions doesn't mean that you're divisive. Politics have become divisive. Why? Part of it is because if you're not embracing the accepted doctrine, then you're a racist. I have been called a racist. My goodness, look at my picture before you start calling me a racist. Please, por favor. I was called a white piece of S in Boston. Just because there was some altercation, I had to turn to the lady and say, mira, por favor, yo soy puertorriqueño. I can speak Spanish, thanks to my parents. She was shocked that I spoke Spanish. Totally, you know, destroyed her like little mindset about what she assumes a well-spoken, articulate person who resists some little temper tantrum wrapped in the guise of victimhood and throw the race card in there as well. And all of a sudden, I brushed that all away by a simple phrase in Spanish. I encourage my friends to have respectful discussions. I want my friends to say, you know, I don't agree with you, but this is how I feel. I don't mean to offend you, and I hope, you know, if you feel offended, we can stop the conversation because my friendship is more important than anything else. But, you know, we have differences of opinion, and that's okay. I want to read this article from a publication of Hillsdale College called Imprimis. Really love this college. I'm a supporter of them. I put my money where my mouth is with causes that I support, and I got a check for these guys coming out today. We'll be right back. You're listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman, and I'll be right back. You're listening to America in the Now with your brother, Henry Roman. I got to talk over the music, otherwise Facebook mutes this segment. So sorry that I'm messing with the diva, but you are listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. Get ready to spell. Ready? Oops. Totally screwed it up. Sorry, guys. We'll listen to it for a few more minutes, and then I'll go on. So important to have respect. So is my money. Let's go. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Suck it to me. Okay, ladies. You are listening to America in the Now with your host, Henry Roman. Absolutely. For those of you who've been listening to me, you know that I have my times when I am just an absolute raving maniac. I'm so full of anger and indignation. It can be a little off-putting to sometimes. I have my friends that call and say, Henry, are you okay, man? You sound so angry. I said, no, man, I'm okay. I'm just, you know, there's a difference between anger and passion. I'm a passionate person. I do. I believe in what I believe, and I want people to believe with me. I want them to understand why I believe what I believe. Everyone has their own journey. You know, you may have been raised in Weston, right? Upper middle class, white neighborhood, went to private schools. Your worldview is going to be very different than mine. I went to PS 332 in Ocean Hill, Bronzeville. I flashed my ghetto card probably a little too much. Maybe I'm overcompensating. I'm just trying to make a point. And that is that different people have different experiences, and they're going to see the world differently. They're going to have different worldviews. But there's always commonality in some way. You know, that uber-rich person and I, we may both love John Philip Sousa, which I do, right? I'm a big fan of marching music. I love marching music. Probably at these John Philip Sousa, how can I put this politely or delicately? You're not going to see a lot of the brothers and people of color at John Philip Sousa concerts. And when you see them, they are definite diehards. I'm one of those people. So you're going to see me there. Does that mean that that's a bad thing? No, you know, if I go to a rap concert, chances are I'll probably be, you know, maybe more people of color than not. Does that make that music better than mine, worse than mine? No, I mean, it's just it's a question of preference. We all have different, you know, preferences, different worldviews. I want to learn about different perspectives. I have my opinions based on how I've learned, how I see the world. But just because it's different doesn't mean that mine's not legitimate. And I really am offended when people like me are called deplorables. When people adopt these fake redneck accents to describe a Trump supporter. This was done on CNN. This guy was making pretend that he was a redneck talking like this. Yeah, I'm a Trump supporter, and I have my guns. And I found that so very offensive, first of all, because my kids, half of their heritage is Southern heritage, Southern white heritage. So I took personal offense at that. Number two, I don't talk like that. I mean, I lived many years in Virginia. And sometimes you'll hear the slight Southern affectation. But you know, I don't talk like that. And I'm not dumb, and I'm not deplorable. And so when they brand people like us like that, I'm very offended. So here's an article from Imprimis. It's actually quite a few pages. I can't read it all. I just want to read a little bit. This was written by Christopher Caldwell. He's a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, author of the book The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s. It says, this was adopted from a talk delivered on January 28th at Hillsdale College, Alan B. Kirby Center for Constitutional Studies and Citizenship in Washington, D.C., as part of the AWC Family Foundation Lecture Series. Cool stuff. You can see the stuff online, by the way. American society is divided by party and ideology in a way it has perhaps not been since the Civil War. It's true, distressing. I've just published a book that, among other things, suggests why this is. It's called The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s. It runs from the assassination of John F. Kennedy to the election of Donald J. Trump. You can get a good idea of the drift of the narrative from its chapter titles, 1963, Race, Sex, War, Debt, Diversity, Winners, and Losers. I can end the part of the suspense right now. Democrats are the winners. Their party won the 1960s. They gained money, power, and prestige. The GOP is the party of the people who lost those things. One of the strands of this story involves the Vietnam War. The antiquated way the Army was mustered in the 1960s wound up creating a class system. What I'm referring to here is a so-called student deferment. In the old days, university-level education was rare. At the start of the First World War, only one in 30 American men was in a college or university, so student deferments were not culturally significant. By the time of Vietnam, almost half of American men were in college or university, and student deferment remained in effect until well into the war. So if you were rich enough to study art history, you went to Woodstock and made love. If you worked in a garage, you went to Da Nang and made war. This produced a class division that many of the college-educated mistook for a moral division, particularly once we lost the war. The rich saw themselves as having avoided service in Vietnam, not because they were more privileged or, heaven forbid, less brave, but because they were more decent. Another strand of the story involves women. Today, there are two cultures of American womanhood, the culture of married women and the culture of single women. If you poll them on political issues, they tend to differ diametrically. It was feminism that produced this rupture. For women during the Kennedy administration, by contrast, there was one culture of femininity, and it united women from cradle to grave. 90% of married women and 80% of unmarried women believed there was such a thing as a woman's institution. Only 16% of married women and only 15% of unmarried women thought it was excusable in some circumstances to have an extramarital affair. 90% of women when asked the ideal age for marriage, said it was sometime before age 27. None answered never. But it is a third strand of the story running all the way down to our day that is most important for explaining our partisan polarization. It concerns how the civil rights laws of the 1960s, and particularly the Civil Rights Act of 1964, divided the country. They did so by giving birth to what was, in effect, a second constitution, which would eventually cause Americans to peel off into two different and incompatible constitutional cultures. This became obvious only over time. It happened so slowly that many people did not notice. Because conventional wisdom today holds that the Civil Rights Act brought this country together, my book's suggestion that it pulled the country apart has been met with outrage. The outrage has been especially pronounced among those who have not read the book. So for their benefit, I should make crystal clear that my book is not a defense of segregation or Jim Crow, and that when I criticize the long-term effects of the civil rights laws of the 1960s, I do not criticize the principle of equality in general or the movement for black equality in particular. I agree with him. What I am talking about are the emergency mechanisms that, in the name of ending segregation, were established under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This gave Washington the authority to override what Americans had traditionally thought of as their ordinary democratic institutions. It was widely assumed that the emergency mechanisms were temporarily and narrowly focused, but they soon escaped democratic control altogether, and they have now become the most powerful part of our governing system. This is a great article. I'm going to read some more of it next week because I want to talk about that. I have issues with some laws. I do believe in equality, obviously. I also understand that, you know, this is not a communist system. We are not 100% equal. Some people are more equal than others. Can I say that? I just want to level playing field. I want the opportunity to compete.
because I have inherent advantages that I intend to leverage to obtain what I want. That's what I intend to use for my state Senate campaign. Please vote for me if you're in the, if you live in Norfolk, Sharon, Rehoboth, Attleboro, Easton, I'm sure I'm missing Foxborough, and I forgot the other place already, and I'm going to have a list. But we need to understand that there are things that have split us apart, and it's time to come together. There are things that we need, there are things that we agree to, and that's what we need to capitalize on. Thank you so much for listening to America in the Now. I am your host, Henry Roman. It was great. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to having you here next Tuesday from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. The phone lines will be open. I will be taking your calls. Until then, take care. God bless. Hug your children. Wash your hands. And be safe. And buy extra macaroni. Forget about the toilet paper. There's none. Bye.